Hi, Simon. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Ferry. How about you?
I'm fine, fine. Good to see you.
And you? What's the weather like there?
It's getting bloody cold over here in Holland right now.
We've got,
and I hope we're going to have a nice, good winter.
Yeah. It'd be nice, wouldn't it? We've got fog and cold here at the moment.
Yeah, that's the same over here at this point. But we hope that's going to change that, and we're going to have a white Christmas or something like that. We need it this year in 2020, a white Christmas. I'm very grateful to introduce our next guest. You've known him for years, so maybe it's better if you introduce him.
Okay, well, this is an old friend, Andy Hill, who runs I Like Music and is one of the great movers and shakers of the music library business in Britain. If you ask him, he'd probably say he's a tech guy rather than a musician, but his very creative mind, very interesting guy to talk to. I'm delighted to say we've got him with us for the next hour, and I'm sure he's going to shed a lot of light on things that we think are rather murky and difficult to understand. I'm sure he's going to throw some light on that. So welcome, Andy.
Hey, Simon, thank you. Always a pleasure to join you. And Ferry, very good to meet you as well.
Did
you? Yeah, great. Well, Andy, perhaps you'd like to just fill us in a bit on your history, how you got into the business, what your entry point was, and where tech met music and when that happened.
Yeah, it does go back a long way. It goes back probably 35 years. And I was at IBM, so as you say, I was on the other side, for want of a better expression. I was one of those, not technical person, but I was a business person. And IBM asked me to go round to their research laboratories where they were spending $7.2 billion a year to see if there was anything interesting that a commercial person would go, what a great invention, drag it out of research, give it to the product guys and go. And in my travels, and I was at Silicon Valley and I was in various different parts of the world where IBM was spending these billions. And I discovered a really interesting, this is in 1988, 89, roughly speaking. And I discovered that some very clever techie guy had worked out how to put music on a big server and then deliver it down to PCs. And I thought, oh, that was interesting. Because when I was at IBM, I'd worked in the city and I'd experienced Big Bang. So it was quite a similar sort of moment. And I went back to the IBM board and I said, look, you know, that's really interesting technology. That's the future of the music industry. And they said, well, what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, that wasn't the question you asked me. You asked me if it was any good. So anyhow, IBM turned around and said, look, you know, if you think it's good, we'll give you the resources, we'll give you the technology, go and set up the world's first online music service, which is what I did. And thankfully, I had some friends who were in the music industry that understood copyright and everything else. And back in 1988, 89, the advice I was given is don't touch record labels, don't touch commercial music, start with library music for the reasons that most of your audience, well, all of your audience will understand, the work, the recording, rate card. So I was then introduced to library music, which at the time I didn't know. And quite literally, a 35-year love affair started with library music, and we launched the first service, which was called Mars PLC, which I'm sure you will remember.
Absolutely.
We launched it at BAFTA, 200, 300 people from the music industry in the morning, 200 people and press in the afternoon, lots to drink, as you would imagine. And we literally launched the world's first music service, but it was using production music. It wasn't commercial music at all. And that was the start of it. And as I say, that's where the love affair, with library music started.
But back in those days, I mean, internet connections were very slow. So how did it work?
Yeah, look, we back in those days, we had compressed the audio to Dolby Digital, which was way before MP3s. We obviously had to use ISDN lines. Do you remember those things? So, of course, and of course, we were only doing business to business. So the customers were businesses that did have about the right bandwidth for that service. So we launched the service. Ironically, our first customer was the BBC. And with all of the libraries, and I'm going back to when it was KPM, Peter Cox, Zomba, Steve Cole with Bruton Chapel. At the time, there was this young upstart called John Lee, who had the Atmosphere catalogue. Russell Emmanuel a few years later was there with the Extreme catalogue. So, you know, I got to meet some amazing people and some great talent. And as you quite rightly say, Simon, I have got so much respect for people who write and compose and record music that I can't. I mean, I literally can't. But you know, I think we can add some great innovation to the library industry. And the reason I like the library industry is they're innovative. They have to be innovative. They have to do things that are different from commercial publishers for the reasons that you know. And techie guys think the same way. You know, our DNAs are very, very similar. How do we make it better? How do we innovate? And libraries are the best at that, in my experience, having dealt with both commercial publishers and labels and everything else. And that's how it started.
So, Andy, what you're able to do is combine data with music, correct? And that gave the ability to catalogue, to search. So I'm wondering when you first presented that idea to people at IBM, to libraries, what was the reaction? Did they go, oh, I've been looking for this for years? Or did they go, it'll never work?
Actually, the very funny story, actually. So don't forget, at the time, IBM is the biggest company in the world. It's got 300,000 people. Its turnover was about 176 billion. Its profits at the time were bigger than Microsoft's turnover. And I got all of the library guys, you know, and I said, come along to IBM's head office in London and I'll show you a demonstration of what we're going to do and what we think the future of library music is. So we did this demonstration. At the end of it, at the end of it, there was two hands that shot up from the audience. And I remember this so well. One was John Lee, who represented or was the founder of Atmosphere. And the other one was Stephen Cole, who was Zomba. And the first question that they both asked is, are the results in alphabetical order? Because Atmosphere would have been at the top and Zomba would have been at the bottom. And do you know what? It taught me one of the best lessons that one question taught me way back then, which is, if we want to do this properly, if we want to do it fairly, we as a company mustn't own a copyright at all, because the minute that we do, we start to have a conflict of interest with the people that we're supposed to be providing a level playing field for. So it was a great lesson in that. And of course, once I started to learn library music and the classification system and everything else, we actually used a brilliant BBC librarian who was a classically trained musician. And she'd been in BBC Information and Archives for about 20 years. And I asked her the question, I said, could you devise a classification system? Because if the user wants to be able to find a piece of music, you need a standard classification system. And that's who we got to write the very first Mars classification service, because data in library world is everything.
Do you still remember how many labels were on board at that time and how many tracks you were talking about?
Do you know, I don't. I mean, you know, Zomba was very big and had lots of labels. KPM obviously had various other labels as well. Obviously, there was Weinberger. I mean, there was lots. I would guess, and I'm just guessing, I would guess 50, 60 odd labels, probably a million tracks, which in 1989 was a big deal.
Absolutely, because how did you store that? Because the storage that we have available right now is incomparable with what you guys had back then.
Oh, another great question. I tell you why it's a great question. Is that obviously you need to have the speed to get it. And again, I'll just give you some quick numbers. Back then, 5 gigabytes of storage cost over £60,000. Today, 5 gigabytes of storage cost about £1. In fact, it's probably less. It's so small you can't even buy it, you know. But that gives you an indication. So what we had is we had the auditioned music, very compressed music for people to audition it. And we had an IBM £200,000 tape library. And this tape library, when someone pressed download, it would literally, like a robot, go and get a tape out, read the tape, find the track, and then it would deliver it.
Wow.
How long did it take?
Oh, well, look, you know, I mean, bearing in mind, it, you know, back then, as long as you could audition it and you knew which track you wanted, so the auditioning was immediate. But the download, you know, took 5 minutes or something, you know, because of that process. But of course, the key thing was identifying the track and selecting it. Once you knew what you wanted to download, you didn't mind waiting 5 minutes because, you know, 30 years ago, the production cycles weren't as compressed as they are today. You know, nowadays, if you can't get it in, you know, in 30 seconds, you're bored, aren't you? So yeah, the world was different and therefore the technology had to be different.
So what was the take-up? I mean, did you feel once you'd given your presentation that you were onto a winner, or did you think, oh, this is going to be a bit of an uphill sort of struggle?
Well, look, there was a million questions, as only good libraries will ask. You know, what's the order going to be? They were all thinking about, you know, all of the libraries will know that they go into the producer at whatever TV company and they would get one set of CDs taken off the eye level and put them at the bottom and put theirs at eye level. And they're all trying to work out how you do that in the digital world. And those were the challenges, was to make sure that you offered a level playing field, but you allowed people to be innovative and creative in their marketing abilities, you know, and their ability to go to someone and say, look, you know, would you mind awfully if my results came at the top of the list? And that's almost the same as my CDs are at eye level. It was translating the realities of what people did with CDs into a digital world that was fair and equitable for everybody, but allowed them to be innovative and creative and marketing. And that those were the sorts of things that we had to think about. And, you know, as I say, the libraries, if you look through history, the libraries were the first ones to go from vinyl to CD. They were the first ones to go online. They've got the best data out of any music anywhere in the world. They have to be innovative. They have to be good. And they have to be creative to get ahead of the commercial repertoire, which has got the advantages that you know about. So it was, you know, it was a challenge, and there was lots of questions that I got from people that you think, oh, I want. And all I used to do is to go, how do you do it today? And how do we replicate that in the digital world, but make it better and more efficient and actually more innovative? And that was how we addressed all of the problems of the libraries.
Did you find that talking about level playing field, people sort of lost interest, or did they like the idea of the level playing field?
Well, as long as they could see that their repertoire was going to be fairly represented and that they could use their marketing skills and, you know, there was obviously the classic where people were trying to change the data with so many classification terms that it became unuseful, not for me, but actually for the end user. And then there was lots of ways of how do we manipulate the data to get to the top of the list. You know, there was all of those sorts of debates. Yeah. But generally speaking, what the libraries could see is that this was the future. And you've got two choices. You either embrace it and try and make sure that technology is used to your best advantage, or you resist it. And unfortunately, if you resist it, it tends to leave you behind. And the catch up is so much harder if you've left it behind.
But the idea behind Mars was one platform, all the libraries combined.
It was. Yes, it was. And of course, you can take those concepts and try and offer it to individual libraries if they wanted to do. But the thing that I've learned from the technology and the technology business is that in certain situations, aggregation is unbelievably a good business model. Tesco's is a good example, right? They aggregate lots and lots of products from lots and lots of people, and they put it on a shelf, and it's a useful product for people who are trying to go shopping. So there's lots of examples where aggregation is a good thing. And, you know, I always know the majors will turn around and say, well, why does anybody need to go to anywhere else other than us? Because they've got all of this repertoire. And I also, they have a great collection of repertoire. But I also understand that the broadcasters, they want the independence to be there. They want the independence to be quick and fast and innovative. And if they just relied with the majors, then what's the incentive for the majors to produce new and exciting repertoire? So it's a balancing act, which has got nothing to do with us. It's to do with the producers of the libraries and the users of the libraries. And the conclusion that we came to is that for that market, aggregation is by far the most useful thing for the end user.
So I remember that years ago in the 90s, we discussed with Stemra, which is the Dutch version of the MCPS, a platform that would host all the libraries. And we thought that they were the partner to do it because they were administrating all those libraries. That didn't happen. And what you see nowadays is that almost every label or every sub-publisher has his own platform. And people are investing in a lot of different platforms. So I think a lot of money is going to waste. And I think that the idea that Mars was offering was a brilliant idea.
Yeah, look, the thing that frustrates me about the technical part of the business, and crikey, I see this with libraries more than anywhere else, is that the libraries are paying for all of these people to host the same music on the same hard disks, and the technology people get richer and richer because, you know, all of Simon's catalogues hosted on three or four platforms, which he's paying for. And I've always disagreed with that principle, but I do agree with the principle of aggregation. And the other thing I always promote is I say, look, aggregation is great, but it shouldn't stop the libraries having their own website and the ability to people to go to their own place. You know, if indeed they wanted to do an exclusive with someone, then why would you want to send them to an aggregator? You know, so there's reasons why if I was a library, I'd want to do both. The thing that would frustrate me if I was a library is, why am I paying three people to host the same stuff, you know, when I don't need to? I mean, that's, and guess what? The technical industry aren't going to turn around and say, oh, you don't want to do that. Why don't you just host it once when they can ask you, get you to pay three times? You know, the Amazon cloud is probably hosting thousands and thousands and thousands of copies of the same time of the same stuff, and it's just unnecessary. And you know, we've got some ideas how you solve that, but it's going to need some collaboration between people like ourselves, Harvest, for example, and the other ones that your audience will know. But it's always been a frustration for me. It's not that I don't want to earn money out of hosting. I want to add value. And if it's going to put my cost up because you've got to pay, you know, three times for hosting, it's just a pointless exercise. And I think that will correct itself, you know, relatively soon as people start to work out that collaboration's better than making Amazon even richer than they are, you know, with their web services.
Yeah. This is an argument I've heard you make a few times about Amazon.
Yeah, look, it's nothing. I mean, I love Amazon. Don't get me wrong. I love them, and I use them, and I, you know, for all sorts of reasons. And whether it's Amazon or anybody else, the same argument would apply. But why is a library's catalogue hosted once for themselves, once for somebody else, once for this, once for that? Because somebody's paying for it, and the libraries know that it always comes back to them having to pay for it. And I've always disagreed with it, because we shouldn't be making money out of hosting. If we can't add value over and above hosting, then we shouldn't be in business. That's the reality of it.
So, Andy, bring us up to the present. Leap forward to I Like Music and when you formed I Like Music and what you saw the market opportunity at that point.
Yeah, look, we were very lucky. We had Mars. We launched the service. We raised $2 million of venture capital from 3i, which was great. We launched it at Bacta, as I mentioned earlier. And then in December 1999, which happened to be the peak of the dot-com boom, is that I was approached and I sold the business, which was fine. Happy to do that. I had all of the requisite lockout clauses and all the rest of it. And so I left that business to the people that bought it, and you know, and I wasn't allowed to compete, so I had to look for something else to do. And you know, as I say, it was the peak of the dot-com boom, and people say to me, with the benefit of hindsight, God, that was genius. And I can tell every one of your audience there was no cleverness involved in it whatsoever. It was pure timing. It was lucky timing, and that's what happened. Now, what happened is that fast forward 2 years, the dot-com bubble burst, and I ended up going and buying back the business that I'd sold 2 years before, which is what created Broadchart International Limited, trading as I Like Music. I literally went back and looked at the commercial catalogue, and we approached the BBC, and the BBC went out to tender to look for an online music service for commercial music, interestingly enough. And we had, as you know, Simon, because you've seen it, the massive Phil Swern collection, which is a collection of, you know, it's 17 to 18 tons of commercial music, CDs, vinyls. A lot of the vinyl we actually bought back from the BBC. So it was the original Phil Swern collection, which the BBC bought 10 years earlier because they thought it was a national treasure, which it is, by the way, it's a national treasure. But then the BBC charter changed and they didn't have to archive other people's stuff. So I went back with my business partner, Phil Swern, and I said, Phil, you know, why don't we go and buy your original vinyl collection back from the BBC and combine it with your new collection? And that's exactly what we did. So the collection that you've seen on our stage, Simon, with tons of music and vinyl, you know, that became it. So when we took it back to the BBC and said, you know, here is an online commercial music service, they signed up for it. And I said, oh, just out of interest, about 700 to 800 people will ask you, where's the library service? And the BBC said to me, well, what should we do about it? I said, tell them it'll be 3 months. So literally, we recreated Mars for the BBC to offer it as a secondary service so that we could offer two services to the BBC, access to commercial repertoire and access to production music. And that's what we, when I bought the business back, that's what we did, and that's what we continue to do today.
Right. So in the time from when you started Broadchart, Andy, to now, obviously, technology has changed enormously. What are the principal changes that you've seen and helped drive?
Yeah, there's a massive number of technology changes. I mean, the fundamental business still exists, which is aggregating quality repertoire. And I can come on to what defines quality, but aggregating quality repertoire, providing unbelievable service to the customer, to the producers, whatever the producers, production companies. Because when you do it on an aggregated basis, you can get those technologies and apply it to all of the libraries. So the aggregation helps. Now, whether that sounds similar, I mean, I could rattle off 5, 6, 7, 8 technologies that I think can really improve the service to a broadcaster. And a lot of those we've got in the pipeline. But the fundamental principle, even valid today, is a music library or production music stored, aggregated with brilliant data. It has to be quality repertoire. And then what the techie people have to do is to find the best technologies to make that service better for the customer. You know, whether that's I want something that sounds similar to a commercial music track and you deliver them production music, you know, or a whole variety of things that you can do. And crikey, I've seen most of the technologies that have come and go, and some that work and some that don't work. But the principle's the same today as it was in 1989, but just with much more technology to improve the service to the end user.
So I'm interested that you place an emphasis on quality, both in terms of music and data. And if you take that as really that's where we should all be headed, and then on the other hand, you've got the level playing field. How do the two play together? How does the quality rise to the top when the technology is trying to level the playing field?
Yeah, so this started... So I'll have to go back in history to explain that and how you move forward. So when we started, we only allowed MCPS libraries to go onto the service. And the reason for that, you just have to go back in history, is for a library to be permitted to be MCPS, they had to, and I don't know the details because I've never been one, but you had to have produced 500 CDs. It was something like that.
Yeah.
And that... if someone could be bothered to do that, they must have confidence in their repertoire, and therefore it must be of a quality for them to take that risk. And that created a really interesting dynamic, which is, so when we're looking to aggregate it, what do we do? Do we just turn around and say, well, anybody, royalty-free, non-MCPS, MCPS? And we took a very clear decision, which is somebody, and I'm going back to 1989, MCPS have defined a way of creating a quality and a level playing field. So we took the view that we would stick to the same thing. We would only allow MCPS libraries on because there was a quality associated with it. It obviously all fell under the BBC blanket, so it didn't, and it created a level playing field.
Yeah.
And actually, it creates a very funny story. Is everyone know the emergence of audio networks, right? So I get a phone call from a livid BBC lawyer. What the hell's this service that you've provided? Why can't audio networks go in it? Da, 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 you know, so I was hauled into the BBC's offices and sat down in front of these sort of slightly annoyed lawyers and said, look, you know, we need maximum access to every bit of repertoire, and we mustn't exclude anyone because we've got this charter to be fair to everyone. I said, oh, thank God you've got this charter to be fair to everyone. I said, just out of interest, are audio networks, being non-MCPS members, working on the same level playing field as the MCPS one? And they went, well, I don't know. And I said, well, you know, maybe that's the question to ask, because what we've tried to do is to make sure it's a level playing field, hence the reason it's only MCPS. And I said, and if audio networks would like to join MCPS, I'll put them on the system tomorrow, you know, because if that's the criteria, which of course they were never going to do. So, you know, I had this great debate with the BBC, and to their credit, they understood exactly what I was saying. They supported 100% what we had put forward, that the service would be, you know, the BBC desktop jukebox would only be MCPS music. But of course, they had to go and do a deal with audio networks just to allow them to be there. But it wasn't part of the aggregated service, so that you could search BBC desktop jukebox for the aggregated library. But if you wanted audio networks, you'd have to go and search somewhere else.
And why did the BBC need to do a deal with audio network?
Well, just to cover the dubbing rights, you know, just to make sure that the public performing side of it was fine, but they needed to make sure that they had the rights to be able to copy it as because they weren't members of MCPS.
So, Andy, do you feel that you're partly holding back a dam of alternate library music, Epidemic, Artist, Shutterstock, that is just waiting to kind of flood us with royalty-free, or do you feel that there are kind of two streams of thought?
Yeah, so what was interesting is that within the BBC tender, and again, I can't talk about too much detail on it, but within the BBC tender, their view was very simple, is they want maximum choice for all of their customers. And I think it's an admirable thing to ask. I'm not sure I agree with the totality of it, because if you get MCPS library, non-MCPS, royalty-free, all put into the same bucket, you know, it ends up being a bucket. And to me, the most important thing is it helpful for the customer, for the person that's trying to find music? And I don't think it is. You know, everyone says that choice is great, but when you go to Tesco's, that's an aggregated service, you know, they don't have 500 different versions of baked beans. They select the best ones because they're about the right price, they're about the right quality, and you don't need 50 versions of baked beans. You need Heinz, maybe an own brand, and a couple of others. And as long as the price is about right, you can do it. Now, with library, the price stays the same. So I don't think that quantity is the right answer. And I suspect that because this is the way the BBC is going, which is it's all about quantity and choice, I think that the BBC producers, and any other producer, by the way, I think this is true for any producer or production company, where they will go is where they can find quality repertoire, with really useful technology to help them get to the answer that they want as quickly as possible. And when they get there, you know, that's what they'll use. And as I suspect, that's where the future is going to lie. It's going to lie with quality, unbelievably good service, really helpful tech. And that doesn't stand hand in hand with quantity, quantity, quantity.
I understand what you're saying, but if you look at marketing and our business, it's been strange, of course, that the price has never been part of the equation. In a normal industry, you've worked for IBM, you had to compete with other companies providing similar equipment and maybe at a lower price or whatever. And production music has never been in that position.
Yeah, and sometimes that's good, and sometimes it's very, very, very bad. You know, I mean, I know lots of libraries that are sitting there going, I can't bid for that because I'm a member of MCPS. So you're right, and I think it does need some careful consideration about how you do that. And my worry is that if you get quantity, 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 it becomes a race to the bottom, right? Because separate deals will be done, you know, all of those different things. And I think that would be wrong for the quality libraries to get put into the same bucket. And I do think the licensing arrangements will change to allow price to become part of it. And as I say, I suspect, particularly on synchronization licenses, there's a really, really clever way of doing it. I mean, a really clever way of doing it, which nobody has really addressed. And the same applies to commercial music as well. So you know, I've worked with various companies that have wanted to do simple synchronization licenses. And I can also see how you can do it. You know, the balancing act is doing it within the societies, which has got some advantages, and then sometimes having to do it outside the societies because you want that price flexibility. And I think that's coming, but I do think the performing societies in particular will be fine because it's just too difficult to do without them. But I suspect the mechanical societies have, you know, will either focus on the quality, and that will just be some sort of measure of quality, or all the libraries should be able to have MCPS represent them for certain things, like, for example, the BBC blanket agreement. But they're also allowed to go and license people like us directly for other activities. And that's where they can start to use the price advantage or disadvantage to their favour.
Because if you look at the past, we've seen Audio Networks, which was basically no or little sync and get the income from the performing rights.
Of course.
What we now see is platforms like Artlist, Epidemic, which is basically one-time fee, and you can do what you want. You can use what you want. That is, of course, already a massive disruption in the market. So how do you compete with that if you are within the structures of MCPS?
Yeah, look, it's difficult. And I think the MCPS have been flexible. So, for example, any member of the MCPS today, if they can remain a member of the MCPS and they can still license me directly, subject to conforming to certain conditions. And I've looked at those those conditions very carefully. And pretty much every library that I know, we could find an arrangement that would allow them to remain part of MCPS, you know, for everything, but then allow me to license it, for example, for synchronization, for example, using music in retail and hospitality is another one. Maybe for using production music in user-generated content. So there are mechanisms, and I respect the MCPS for doing this, which is to allow the libraries to remain members of MCPS where it's applicable, like, for example, a BBC blanket, but then license people like myself directly. And they have got some conditions in them, which is quite right and proper, but that allows me to take your repertoire to a market. But it still sits within the PRS and the public performing infrastructure, which I do think is right. You know, who's going to license every hairdresser, every pub, every retail shop? It's never going to happen. So you need the ability to do the mechanical, the synchronization license directly with someone like myself. And that, and I don't mean that in any way competitive to MCPS, because that's not what they do. But you can still say a member of MCPS to enjoy the BBC blanket agreement if that's what you choose.
And Andy, when you look at the big PROs, do you, and you look into the future, do you see that each country will maintain its own PRO, or do you see some kind of aggregation of the PROs?
Yeah, look, the, on the performing side of it, they have you know, particularly, you know, the broadcasters is quite an interesting one, because, you know, you can deal with them directly if you need to. But when it comes to the public performing side of it, I think the societies that look after that, the ASCAPs, the BMIs, the PRSs, et cetera, I think they will continue. And I think the mechanical side of it, the synchronization side, will change dramatically. So, but what I also think is going to happen, I mean, we've looked at all of this monitoring technology for, crikey, 30 years. I mean, if you want to go back in history, it was a KPM track that we put a watermark in 25 years ago, and we transmitted it up to a satellite and back down, and we could identify with 100% accuracy that it was a KPM track that was transmitted. And since then, we've looked at all sorts of, you know, the Digimark technology, all the watermarking and fingerprinting technology. So we're very aware of that. And I've, you know, we recently signed a heads of terms with a company that today, right, today, they are monitoring over 8,000 radio and TV stations today, and at the flick of a switch they can increase that to about 86,000 radio and TV stations around the world. And the minute you've got that capability, the minute you've got that, and the price of doing it, by the way, was remarkably low, because I've watched this market for 25 years and I've seen it start like most technology, which is unbelievably expensive. There's no point paying that to save, you know, a 20p, you know, public performer. I mean, it's a pointless thing to try and get the technology to do it. Where technology is really, really interested is when you get to economies of scale. And therefore, it is worth finding every time a performance is made for 5p, 20p or whatever. And that's when you get the real benefits of these things. And when you can monitor 86 or whatever it was, 1,000 radio stations and TV stations, then it starts to become really, really interesting, which is, and I've had publishers say it to me, they go, so if you can deliver the music and you can tell me what's been played, why do I need a society? You know, why do I need one? And the answer is, over time, the societies are either going to evolve, right, you know, into more efficient, they're going to use technology and all the rest of it, you know, or publishers are going to come to the techie people and say, look, can you deliver my music? Yes. Can you tell me what it's played? Yes. Can you charge people for it? Yes. Okay, well, what do I need a society for? But having said that, the societies, particularly the public performing societies, particularly in places like retail and hospitality and user-generated content, is that, you know, the societies and the society infrastructure is already set up. And therefore, you know, that is a good thing. And therefore, the transition to a more competitive society network will take a little bit of time.
It's very interesting, because what you're just describing now is something that I've been thinking of for a long, long time. You are able to distribute the music to end users. You will, in cooperation with the company you're mentioning, will be able to track usage on radio stations, TV stations around the world. The registration of those titles could also go through your system, I assume.
Yep.
With all the societies. Where does that leave the sub-publishers?
Well, look, that's a really, really good question. And I think, you know, what you have to do is to section it out for two things. You have to say, what does technology enable people to do, which is one question. And all of the things that you've said are absolutely correct. And then you have to ask yourself, well, how does that fit into how people are doing it today? And, you know, as I say, I've never owned a copyright for the reasons I mentioned before, because I don't want to compete with anybody. But when I do look at it from the outside and I see what sub-publishers do, of all of the people that I think are at risk is the sub-publishers, unless they don't have a conflict of interest. In other words, they're publishing their own stuff and sub-publishing somebody else's. And that just creates a conflict of interest because they want their repertoire to be used before the repertoire that they're sub-publishing. So I think that's always a dangerous thing to do. But if somebody wants their catalogue represented in a different territory and they don't have the resources to sell it, then they do need somebody else to sell it, which in your language is a sub-publisher. Now, if somebody adds value, sells it, gets it installed in places, they should be paid. But if they're just bundling it with their catalogue, where there becomes a conflict of interest, you know, I'm not so sure that's going to survive the test of time, because technology just stops that happening.
Andy, one of the things that characterises our business and which frustrates particularly young composers and new composers coming into it is the time it takes for the money to arrive. Say, let's a piece of music's used in America. The money goes to the sub-publisher. They hang on to it for a bit. Then it comes over here. And, you know, it could be a year and a half, 2 years before you see the music that you know has been used on a piece of television. Does technology have an answer to this? I mean, I've heard that blockchain might absolutely revolutionise this, so that at the point at which something's shown, the money could be straight in the bank account of the people concerned. Is that a dream, or is that something that you would be looking at?
Hey, Simon, I could do that tomorrow. And one of the funniest conversations I've ever had was when back in the Mars days, and I was trying to understand how this weird industry called the music industry works. So I'm asking George Barker a question, and George is brilliant because he looks at things. He's first of all passionate about what he does. But the other reason I like George is that he's unbelievably critical because he's passionate about getting the right answer. And I've become a good friend of George, because if I want an idea tested, George will look at it. He will criticize it to the nth degree, which I love the fact. But the reason he's doing it is not because he's negative, it's because he wants the right answer. And I discovered that 35 years ago when I first met George, and I love him for doing so. But this comes back to a story that I always remember asking George. I said, George, so tell me how the money happens. He said, it's amazing. He said, we produce a CD. And I go, great. I said, then what do you do? He said, we send it to broadcasters. And I said, how much do you charge them for? He said, no, we give it to them. And I go, okay, so no money's changed hands. I said, then what happens? He said, then they use it. And I said, then do you get paid? He said, no, they don't pay then. We get it about 9 months later. And I couldn't stop laughing. I could not stop laughing. I said, hold on a second. If I was Marks and Spencer, right, this is the same as I'm delivering you a load of suits, right? Oh, I don't want to charge you for them, so just stick them on the shelves. And then the customer can come along and try them on, right? And they can take them away. Now, if they go out for dinner with them, they'll pay you for it. But they won't pay you when they went out to dinner. They'll pay you 9 months later. And this is how George described the money flow. And I couldn't stop laughing because it to me, it made no sense. I've come from IBM, principally in the city, where they do billion-pound transactions that are settled literally a second after the button's pressed. And I'm sitting there going, hold on a second. Why does a composer have to wait 9 months, if not longer, for it to be paid? So to answer your question today, right, if you can deliver the music and you can identify that it's been played, monitoring, and once you've identified it's played, you can then ask for someone for some money and get it paid, then the answer is you pay it straight away. And just to finish on that point, the other way that you can do it is that if I'm a young publisher and I've got the monitoring technology and I can see that one of my tracks has been put into BBC Blue Planet, for example, and you can see that it's being monitored, you can use that data to go to your bank and say, look, it's been used. This is the rate card. Can I have an advance against the money that I'm guaranteed to be paid? You know, you need a society to be able to, you know, I mean, yeah. We all know the difficulties about it's been played, but I haven't been paid. But you get the principle.
I do, yeah.
But don't you think that you just, that's the core of the problem the business is in right now? If you see the new initiatives, they provide money to the composers directly, maybe upfront. It's a one-time fee, but the composer gets the money instantly. He doesn't have to wait for income for 9 months and then even know exactly how much money he's going to get.
Yeah, look, the answer is technology allows something to be delivered, played, monitored, and paid for within seconds. So that's the reality of the opportunity. What you've got to ask yourself is, why doesn't the music industry want that to happen? What are the infrastructures in place that avoid that happening? You know, and I remember being told ages ago, one of the European societies didn't charge any commission on the administration of people's musical works. But what they did do is they charged, they didn't pay it out for 2 years. And at the time when inflation was 10-15% and they were getting an interest payment in the bank of 10 or 15%, they didn't need to charge a commission. Yeah. You know, so you've got to ask yourself the question, what is the reason for the delay and who's motivated by the delay? And those are the people that are the most at risk. They're at most at risk. And
sorry, it's an interesting story that you're telling, because I know exactly which society you're talking about. I'm not going to say it's based in Holland, but it actually is. The funniest thing was that their financial director said, we have a euro coming in and a euro going out. So I asked him, so you all work for nothing? No. We make money. On what? And they make money exactly as you just described, on keeping hold of other people's money.
Yeah, as a general rule, all of the technologies, all of the businesses that I've seen outside the music industry, where those businesses have failed, it's because they can see what technology does and they don't react to it quickly enough because they're trying to hold on to the past. And whether we like it or not, you know, and there's lots of things I wish technology companies didn't do, but whether we like it or not, the technology's there. And if somebody doesn't do it, somebody else will. That's just the nature of a marketplace.
Andy, interesting. Holding on to the past, a conversation just before we started that Fair and I were having was about holding on to the past in the sense of albums. We still make albums and people spend time deciding on the order of the album why is an album? That's an outdated concept. I mean, it's all about the track now, isn't it? It's good search, find the track. The album doesn't mean anything. And yet we're all kind of rooted in this concept of albums. ILM release albums. That's your latest release. You go to its albums. So would you say that's one area where we're still holding on to the past? Or do you like the idea of an album? Do you think it's still a kind of good box to put music in?
Yeah, one likes the sort of touchy-feely part of it. You know, technology divorces you from things sometimes too much. And I think people still like the sort of the pretense of touchy-feely albums. You know, one of the things I've always said to libraries is, why don't you make a one-track album? You know, don't wait. You know, when you've recorded it, get it out there, get it catalogued, get it into the system. And do it track at a time. And if you want to add a track, you know, one of the beauties about technology is you don't have to wait for, you know, 30, 40 tracks to be put into place before you can release the CD, because you needed to fill it up, you know, because it was silly. So the advantage of technology is you don't have to wait for the CD to be filled up. And what you've got to do is to work out, how do I keep the concept that people enjoy at the, you know, at exactly the same time as doing what's in the best interest. So, you know, you write a track today, that should be in front of a whole bunch of users today, because that's what technology allows you to do. Now, again, you've got to make sure you don't appear silly, because, you know, here's my new album and it's got one track in it. You know, you've got to work out how you present it. But the reality is that, you know, what I say to libraries all the time is, if you know you've got a really good track and it's not being used, change the classification of it. You know, change it. You know, try something data-wise that's different to maybe just change how it's found. I say to libraries, you know, why are you waiting for 50 tracks? Why don't you have a 5-track album and just get it out there? You know, because technology allows you to do it. So technology is great because it's got flexibility, but you've got to use it to your advantage. But I still like albums.
Question for you. Can you see that certain titles of songs are popular because there are certain words in there?
Well, you know, what users search for is an amazing sort of minefield, for want of a better expression. So being able to see what people search for is important. Being able to share that data with people is important because it helps them. What you've got to be careful about is that you don't use data to make every decision. You know, so if everyone was deciding on, you know, an upbeat piano concerto or whatever it might be, you know, if people see everyone searching for it and everyone goes and classifies their track to be that, it doesn't become useful. And what I say to libraries is classify it the way that it was meant to be for, you know, so what's the purpose of it, and classify it accordingly and be as accurate as you can. But don't worry at all about changing that classification next week because you know, it's not being used and it's a great track.
Andy, maybe this is what led Ferry to ask the question, but last week I released an album on your platform, Sports Underscores. Very energetic music, absolutely aimed at the sports people. Friday night, I'm dozing in my chair watching Newsnight, and a story about Brexit comes up and how short the time is for Brexit to be decided. Wait a minute, that's my music. Wait a minute, we only released that on Monday. What's that track called? Clockwork. Ah, so what happened was that somebody at the BBC in the news department put in time or clock is ticking. No respecter of the fact that we produce sports music, they just went straight there, and it was the title that gave them the clue. They pulled the track out, they listened to it, they thought, that's perfect. And they used it. I mean, that to me is the technology working beautifully. And in a sense, it's a relief for me that our music doesn't just get used for sport. But it's also really emphasising Ferry's point that the title of the track can sometimes be really important, because perhaps the search engines find that first. I don't know. But anyway, thank you.
No, but that's great. And I love it when technology works. And the thing that's going through my brain is, so you've written it, recorded it, you know, posted it on us, it's been delivered, it's been played on a BBC news items. The bit that's missing is, and why weren't you paid on Saturday morning?
Yeah, it's all right. I got a bank loan based on it, don't worry.
You understand my point, but I do.
In a sense, I throw the question back to you. I mean, we're looking to you guys to solve that one. And you know, when I speak to my tech guys, they say, well, blockchain's going to do that. That's going to be the point at which, you know, that kind of data is attached to a file. I don't really know.
Well,
look,
blockchain is great. I've studied it. I understand it. I can see how everyone looks at it as the holy grail to get paid next week. You know, the answer is, it's not the technology. The technology can do exactly what you want today, right? So it's not the technology that's stopping this stuff happening. And what typically happens, and I've seen this in the music industry, is that you say, well, here's something that works today. And they've read somewhere that something else is coming. And I tell you what, let's wait for the next thing to come. And what happens is you push the can down the road. And the golden rule with technology is there's always something that's going to come better. There always is, right? There's a better thing of everything that's going to come next week, next month, and next year. What you've got to do is, the train's leaving the station, just jump on it. And as it gets better, right, go with the train, go with this, go with that. And the worst thing, the worst decisions I've ever seen in business are decisions to do nothing. And they're always the most costly decisions, because you are making a decision. The decision is to do nothing.
Yeah.
And in tech world, every time someone's go, well, I'm going to leave it, it always ends up costing them much more money than if they'd just got on the train and gone for the journey.
Yeah, good stuff. So, Andy, our hour is nearly up, and I think we'd love to ask you to come back again and keep going. But I just must ask you one question, which is about AI. And this seems to divide our business between those people who are dreading it writing the music for us and other people who see it as a very useful tool. It's going to provide useful tools. Where do you stand on this?
Yeah, so I've been studying this for 20, 30 years. When, do you remember IBM had a thing called IBM Big Blue? And it was a computer program that beat the world chess champion. It was a Russian guy in the world. In other words, that a computer could beat someone at chess. And as you know, maths and music has got a very strong association. So I was really fascinated. I thought, I wonder if, you know, a computer like Big Blue could compose a number one hit. I was just fascinated with it. Fast forward 10, 15 years, whenever something musical comes up, IBM give me a bell and they go, what do you think of this? And about, I don't know when it was, mid-90s or something, IBM phones me up and said, oh, we've got this other technology and it's really clever, but it scrapes all of the data from all of the social media platforms. And I've gone, yeah, well done. Anyway, what was the purpose of it? And they said to me, they will tell me what's going to be number one next week. Hmm. And I went, really? I'm thinking about having a bet at the bookies to see whether Take That's going to beat Bross or something like that. I didn't tell them that, obviously, but that was what was going through my brain, which is, you know, and I know all of the pluggers of the past that go and buy the records from HMV to get to the number one. And this is just technology moving it to the next stage. But literally, they could scrape all of the social media data and they could tell you what tracks were going to be in the top 10 the following weeks. And I'm sitting there going, ah, you see, that's interesting. If you take Big Blue beating a chess championship and you're looking at all of this data to be able to create a number one hit, would that work? And then what happened was another really funny thing that happened. My son introduced me to a university college who happened to be a scholar, a musical scholar at Cambridge University, and he was also a brilliant mathematician. And when he left Cambridge, he decided that he would start up the world's first AI company to compose music. And it was called Duke Deck. That's right, Duke Deck. And his name was Paddy something. Lovely, lovely guy. So because I'm in music, which I'm not, I'm just in technology, my son introduced Paddy to me. And this is 5-6 years ago. So Paddy came into the office and he said, I'm going to get a computer to compose an amazing bit of music. And I said, well done, Paddy. Let me hear it. And it was plinky, plonky, plinky, plonk. And I went, hey, Paddy, fantastic. You know, you're not quite there yet, but give me a shout. And every year I used to get Paddy over and I said, how's it going, Paddy? And it was plinky, plinky, plinky. I mean, it was better and it got better and it got better and it got better. And of course, all I'm doing is I'm looking at it to go, I need to let the libraries know what's coming and how they can fit in with this. But anyhow, literally last year, it might have been the year before, I phoned up Paddy for my regular update and the music was getting better. And shortly afterwards, he sold the business to TikTok. TikTok came along and bought it from him. So I've gone, oh, that's interesting. And I can see what TikTok want to do. They just want to make, you know, effectively royalty-free music for the videos that people are doing. And by the way, it wasn't that good. It was, you know, the quality issues was nothing like a BBC person could use or an ITV person or anybody else.
It wasn't plinky plonky anymore, but ticky tocky.
Yeah, well, yeah. Very, what an absolute, yeah, absolutely right. It was getting, but all I could tell you is that it was getting there. And then about two months ago, I got a phone call from a guy who'd been asked to invest in a music opportunity in California. And he said, look, because it's music and he doesn't understand it, would I mind going on the call? And I said, well, what's the theme of it? He said, oh, it's artificial intelligence. And I went, oh, great, I'll go on the call. So anyhow, so I looked at this and it was really, really good. And to answer your question, Simon, there's two ways that can go. Is the people that had invented it, I said to them really clearly, I said, here's a question for you. Do you want to be a music publisher that's using technology to get a competitive advantage, which is option one? Or option two is, do you want your technology to be used by the music publishing industry to help them make their products better? And the founder of the business said, Andy, he said, never once have we asked that question. And I said, the reason you need to ask that question is you can't do both. What you cannot do is to go and say, I'm a music publisher, and then get everyone to use your technology because there becomes a conflict of interest.
Yeah.
And again, cutting a long story short, I've turned around to them and I said, look, if you want to go off and be a music publisher, that's great. If you want to license me the technology exclusively, I said, I know exactly how to apply that to the advantage of our library customers that will make the service that they can give to the broadcasters and the production companies so much better. But I'm not there yet, but I've asked the question, I've asked for an exclusivity, and if I get it, you guys will be the first person I'll come and speak to. So
what a cliffhanger, what a cliffhanger.
Yeah, and the answer to that question is, if you adopt these technologies and use them to your advantages, they don't become a threat. If you close your eyes to them, they will take you over. And I think there's a really good opportunity for publishers. If I can get the exclusive, I'll be on the phone straight away.
Well, thank you very much, Andy. It was a very interesting, inspiring conversation that we had, I think. I want to thank you very much for your time, for being here. We're going to invite you back. That's one thing, that's for sure.
Hey, look, I really enjoyed it. As I say, I've got a love affair with library music, which is not, there's not many techie people that can say that. And that's because we share this same DNA. So I'd be happy to come back, talk to you and to all of your audience anytime that you would like.
Great. Well, many thanks, Andy. Really appreciate your time.
Brilliant.
Good. Bye.
See you.
Cheers, guys. Thanks a lot.
Cheers, Nat.